Today's Bureau Briefing is brought to you by MailChimp. More than 16 million people, businesses, and agencies around the world use MailChimp's marketing automation platform to reach their customers and grow their businesses. Their features and integrations give agencies the power to help their clients succeed through marketing emails, automated messages, and targeted ad campaigns. Their detailed reports help clients keep improving over time and provide agencies with the insight they need to effectively advise their clients and inform their marketing strategies. MailChimp loves empowering agencies and small businesses alike, so that's what they focus on every day. And we thank them so much for making the Bureau Briefing possible.
Welcome to the Bureau Briefing, a podcast by the Bureau of Digital, an organization devoted to giving digital professionals the support system they never had. Each episode, we're going to talk to a member of our community doing awesome, inspiring things. Now for your host, Carl Smith.
Hey, everybody, and welcome back to the Bureau Briefing. It's Carl, and with me today, I have the founder of Marketing Mentor. That's marketing-mentor.com if you want to check it out. And also the program partner for How Design Live and an amazing business coach, it's Elise Benin. How's it going today, Elise?
Thank you. I'm really well today. Thank you.
Well, I'm excited to have you on the show because as a lot of the listeners know, I was not a very good owner of my shop. Somehow we succeeded in spite of me. And one of the issues I always had was just getting our name out there. Now, we were kind of irreverent, and we had like an organized chaos kind of vibe. But I'm curious, when you meet with most digital agencies, what are they struggling with?
Well, the first issue is the fact that what they are doing for their clients, which is helping with marketing, they're not doing for themselves. So they're not practicing what they preach. And that's a red blot or a black blot on them, in my opinion.
And so do they, I mean, when you meet with them, do you make them look in that mirror and just ask them why?
Yes, but I've heard all the excuses, so it's really just for them to articulate to themselves why they're not doing it. And then usually the problem has to do with not knowing exactly what they should be doing because, you know, let's face it, there are so many different marketing tools that we could be using. And it can be very overwhelming for most people. And so paralysis sets in and you do nothing. So that's the first hump we try to get over.
Now, one of the things that I think was beneficial for my shop, for Engine, was that I didn't really have any skills when it came to building or designing anything. I was an okay writer. I was pretty good at promotions, but I never got sucked into the work. And a lot of the agencies that I meet with, I find out that, you know, the principal, the founder, is also a designer or a developer or something like that. So when the work comes in, they stop looking for more work. Do you see that a lot?
Is that
hey,
gonna
Fanny.
Be a problem? Yeah.
No, it's totally fine. Nobody listens to this show.
Because I can give her a treat.
Give her a treat anyway, because that would just be awesome. Is it because there's just not a dedicated person to keep the marketing efforts going?
That is part of it, yes. And the other part is that most of us don't get into this type of business because we want to market it. We get into it because we want to do it. And if someone else is not doing it, then it's the thing that essentially falls to the bottom of the pile, unless you're absolutely desperate, in which case, by then it's actually too late.
Yeah, that's an excellent point. And you could hear it when I was just trying to speak. That's an excellent point. Because even this week with the Bureau, like we have a lot of marketing efforts. We're sharing what people in the community are doing. And, you know, we're trying to get our own voice out there and doing things. And then I had this opportunity to fix a problem and I disappeared for 3 days. Just like putting together this new solution for something. And when I looked up, all of our channels were dry. I was like, we're not saying anything. We're not doing anything. nobody knows we're here. So what do you tell those shops? Like, what do you recommend to them when they're in that place?
Well, there have to be, I mean, there are ups and downs in every business. And sometimes, obviously, there's going to be more time available to focus on marketing. And other times, there's going to be no time at all. And so you need to have a system in place, what I like to call a marketing machine, that is already in place and has all the pieces ready so that when things get really busy, you know exactly what you have to do and it doesn't take long at all. And you can keep the machine running. And part of doing that is making sure that during the slower times, you are filling the machine and creating content, for example, or researching prospects so that when you do get busy, you can still keep it running.
Which, again, makes great sense. I have people ask me how you can do a weekly podcast. And I said, it's easy. You just schedule 2 episodes a week, but publish one. Mm-hmm. Because that's the only way that you're going to be okay when somebody cancels, and you've got to have like 8 or 10 in the can just sitting there waiting, because you're going to have something come up in your life. And when it does, you've got to keep moving. So what are the things right now that you see agencies doing that are really successful when it comes to marketing?
Well, to me, the most important foundational marketing tools, there are 3 of them. And this presumes you know who you're marketing to. If you don't know who you're marketing to, then none of these tools work.
I like you. I like you a lot.
Right? So who are you marketing to? That is actually one of the biggest challenges people have for lots of different reasons, which I'm sure you already know, which is I don't want to limit myself. I can't decide. I've got lots of different things. I like variety, blah, blah, blah.
So what are the three things that you tell them to do?
Okay. So networking in person, in real time, whenever possible, email marketing to stay in touch with the people that you meet through that networking, and direct outreach, which is kind of like cold calling, but not really, because it's warm, number one, and it's a combination of email, snail mail, phone call, social media, to get the attention of the people who are your ideal clients, who you really want to work with, who you've carefully identified and selected for certain reasons because you've done your homework. And then you're going to explain in a very personalized way why you're reaching out to them. And then you're not going to give up even when there's silence and they don't respond, because you're going to emphasize the fact that you're serious and you're not going away.
Now, when you talk about outreach, direct outreach, that's something that I've tried. And when I was at Engine, we would try it. And sometimes it would work. What we found was we had, and people get cranky. I am totally against any type of spec work. But I will say that if you're building something to show someone your capabilities and they didn't ask you to do it, I don't consider that spec work. That's you doing something with the intention of getting something, not being told to do something. So anyway, that's how
I agree with you about that.
Good. Finally, I found the one person on the planet. But like, I've seen some shops that have built amazing things and use that to get in the door. Mm-hmm. I mean, hell, 37 Signals redesigned FedEx.
Exactly.
FedEx didn't know anything about them, yet people suddenly thought they were a client. Mm-hmm. And we did that as well. We used to interview other companies and talk about how great they were just so we could put their logo on our homepage. It's so bad, but it totally worked. So I think my question when we talk about this outreach, I struggled with it because, like with the Bureau, I'm trying to find new shops. And sometimes I'll see a shop that's doing something great and I want to reach out and I want to say, hey, you're doing something great. If I do it on Twitter, sometimes you'll hear back, but you don't even know if that's the company, right? You don't even know if you're talking to somebody who's actually there. And if you use like their tools like Hunter, where you can get email addresses from people on LinkedIn and things like that, I guess it feels kind of intrusive. So like, how do you recommend that people do that initial outreach so that it is warm, it's not cold?
I think the first mistake is thinking that the initial outreach is just one effort. It's not. It's a combination. It's anything and everything it takes to get the right person's attention. And you may not know that you've gotten their attention right away. So it is a combination of social media, including Twitter, perhaps LinkedIn, whatever they're on, basically, and email and snail mail and maybe phone. That's the initial outreach.
So what would you do snail mail wise?
Oh, you can. Actually, I have on my desk a very simple card, a note card that was sent to me by a client, actually. So he personalized, it's a thank you card, but he said that he uses it also as his warm snail mail intro to people he wants to work with. So he just sends it to them with a nice personalized note and his card, his business card, which is very cool and three-dimensional. And that is the first effort. And then he follows up with an email that says, did you get the card? And then he maybe will link with them on LinkedIn, and then maybe he'll phone call, but all sending the same message. Did you get the card? I'm interested in working with you.
So when we started Engine, we didn't have a whole bunch of money. And what we did was we actually went to Dun & Bradstreet. We looked anywhere that Southwest would fly because we knew they were cheap. We got a database of companies that had grown either number of employees or revenue an unbelievable amount within a 3-year period. We just had this theory that they'd be outgrowing their systems. They would know what was going on. And then we would shoot out on Fridays. We would open some beer and we would send out like 500 letters, just plain letters. And we actually landed Bayer Pharmaceutical off one of those stamps. So like 32 cent stamp turned into a $140,000 project.
Yeah, that doesn't surprise me.
It's amazing. And see, I was talking to somebody, actually, across the street from my office, there's this little pizzeria. And I was talking with the owner of it, Patrick. It's Patty's. And I was talking to Patty. And he said, hey, you know what? I think I'm going to go back to, he said, putting flyers on people's windshields. And I was like, Patty, people hate that. He's like, yeah, but we did it when we started. And you know what? We had so much business. And I said, why'd you stop doing it? He goes, because we had so much business. And I realized a lot of those early efforts we stopped doing because maybe we were uncomfortable or we weren't sure about them, but they were really successful.
They work.
Yeah. Why do you think a lot of shops that have that early success move away from what gave them that success?
Two reasons come to mind. One is they don't want to be doing it in the first place. They don't like it and they can't wait to stop. So when it starts to work, then you say to yourself, oh, I don't have to do this anymore, as if there's an end to marketing, which there isn't. I mean, even I have people who say, what about that successful person or that successful agency? They're not marketing themselves. What are you kidding? How do you know about them? That's how they're marketing themselves.
Exactly, right? And that's the thing, you know, exactly. That I know this is an old saying that great work gets great work, or how it was originally worded, but that's one of the things that I don't see near enough of is people promoting the work that they do. Mm-hmm. There's so many great shops that if they were to just take more time to, and not even case studies, because case studies are tough because clients won't always tell you. Like, so you're kind of fudging around that you think it did well. But just that opportunity to put it out there and share the process. You know, for a while, there were a lot of people who were like live blogging the work that they were doing. And those things were crazy mm-hmm. popular.
So let me say something about case studies, because I think case studies are the perfect marketing tool, the best marketing tool. And I'm actually developing a product around it because of that. And it's not whether or not the a client will give you the metrics or the information and the results. If they will, or if you can get them, and you usually have to set that up from the beginning, then that's even better. But it's process that people don't understand. The client doesn't understand the process you go through. And the case study, the reason that it's a perfect marketing tool is because it elucidates your process, basically. So people understand and can therefore hopefully justify the prices you're charging. And so it makes sense to me that the live blogging also would be very effective because it is another way to show process.
Yeah, and show who you are and the relationship and the culture mm-hmm. around the work. Now, you said something interesting, which is, you know, a lot of times people don't really get that permission, right? They haven't really gotten permission to get the information, to find out what was effective and what wasn't. And for us, I know sometimes we would just dive into the work. And a lot of times without an agreement, which is not smart. But in those agreements, when we did have them, and we got smarter about it later on, we would always have a clause that if we weren't allowed to market or share the work, that our rate was going to go up 25%. And that the reason was, this was the only value we would ever get out of the project. And a lot of times clients would just be like, okay, like we had clients like Chase and Epic Games and AT&T, and some of them were just like, yeah, we're not going to play your game. But do you find that there are a lot of shops that get in trouble because they just dive in without any kind of agreement?
Yes, I see that a lot. In fact, for some reason this week, I heard from several clients who had a variation on that problem. And so we've been brainstorming a lot about that this week. And I think one of the problems is that you don't want to piss anyone off at the beginning of a relationship, as if saying, here are the terms we've agreed to. Do you agree to this? That why would that piss someone off? I don't get that.
No, it's valid. You know, I'll tell you, on the second date I had with my now wife, I told her on the second date that I really, really, really liked her and I never wanted to get married. And I just thought she should know that now. And, you know, I mean, we've been married 17 years, but it was one of those things that I always felt like if there's something that's going to happen, I'd rather get it out up front. When we did proposals, the very first thing you'd see on the proposal was the price. We never buried it. We always had it right up front. We said, if you want to understand how we got here, you can keep reading. But it's really, really interesting to me. And the other thing is, it levels the playing field that you're a real business, right? A lot of times digital agencies just start doing the work and they establish that tone that the client can just get stuff.
Yes. And I think people are interested in making the client happy. I don't think happy clients are the goal. The goal is doing good work. And I agree with you that if you try to set that tone from the beginning, what you're sacrificing is respect, actually, because I do think that the client expects to negotiate with a professional. And if you don't negotiate, if, for example, they say, here, we'll give you $X thousand for it, and you just say okay, no matter, even if that's a big number to you, you have to negotiate because that's how you earn respect.
Yeah, absolutely. And that was another one of the things that we found as we continued to evolve as an agency, was that when we found the same problems happening again and again, we eventually realized the client had not done the work as many times as we had. And we would establish that in an opening meeting, and we would say, we would actually sit at the table and we would introduce ourselves. And I would say, hi, my name's Carl. I'll be in charge of the high level of the project, keeping an eye on it. And I have overseen 74 web projects. And then we would go around the table until the client was at the end. And they would not say normally how many web projects they had overseen, but we had established at the table that they had not done near as much as we had. Right. And that was an amazing way to kind of level that playing field. And eventually those things even worked their way into our agreements, right? But by being able to establish who had the say over what type of situation or issue in the project.
So now I think what you're talking about is self-respect. And this is the other side of the coin, that if you don't come to the table with self-respect, then there's no way that you're going to negotiate the best deal for yourself and your agency. And there's no way that the client is not going to walk all over you, basically. Even the nice ones are under so much pressure to get more for less that they don't sometimes even know that they're asking for more than you've agreed to do. You can't assume that.
No, and sometimes they've got something going on and they might not understand the way that the work has to happen for the project to evolve, to work. And they may have something else coming on. We had a client that was an oil company Northville Oil, and I was sitting at the table and I had lowballed the project because we needed it. We needed the cash flow. And the client looked at me and he goes, "I'm not going to sign this." And I was like, "Why?" He goes, "Carl, you've got to make a decision." And I'm like, "What?" He goes, "Do you want to put your kids through school or do you want to put my kids through school?" Because I got to tell you right now, I own an oil company. My kids are okay. You need to figure out what this is going to cost because I don't want you getting upset halfway through it. That was the biggest education I had ever gotten in making sure that I was estimating properly, or at least making sure that I was doing something that felt like we were going to get through it. Because you know, it's always crazy. Mm-hmm. But when he explained that to me, when he said that, and I came back with nearly twice as much in the estimate, and he was totally fine. But the reality is, a lot of times when we grab that project early, we just start working, and then we start blaming the client 6 weeks in, when the reality is they just did what we expected them to, what we wanted them to.
So you got very, very lucky, obviously, with a very high quality client who valued your services. And I think that is rare, but worth looking for. Worth looking for is the same way as, you know, looking for high quality friends is worth the time and effort and not wasting your time on losers, basically. And I also think, though, that when you're not in that situation and you know that you have underpriced something, you can still help yourself. And I was thinking, as you were talking, about a situation I put myself in not too long ago where I lowballed it, not because I was trying to get the job, but because I didn't realize that this client could pay more. And so when I gave my price, I could tell by their response that it was too low. And I went back the next day and I said, "You know what? I've been thinking about this and I realized I didn't charge enough and I'd like to redo the proposal and make it higher. Would that be okay with you?" And they said, "Yes."
Wow.
Yeah.
It is one of those situations where when you realize that you haven't done it correctly, you know, and you acknowledge it and you're honest. I mean, that's a whole nother level of establishing a relationship with a prospect, mm-hmm. right? Before they even become a client.
And actually, that makes me think of something else I was discussing with a client today who had come to me, one of these situations where it was a rush job. She did not go through her proven process of getting the information she needed from the client. She made all sorts of assumptions about what the need was, and she was wrong. And it turned into a big problem with the client who needed it fast and then got the wrong thing. But I advised her, I kind of coached her through the process, and it was a positive outcome. And we talked about today how that is actually a very positive experience to go through with that client that she wants to work with again. And now they have a much more solid relationship than if she had done the right thing in the first place.
I'm glad that worked out.
But I love that idea that you don't have to hate yourself for the mistakes that you make, because they can have even stronger effects on the relationships. Because I guess the point I would make from the beginning, from one of your first questions, is most agency owners do not understand that marketing is about relationships. That's all it is. And so all of your marketing tools and efforts should be designed to cultivate relationships with ideal clients. That's what you're doing.
Well, Lise, I got to tell you, we're just going to leave it there. I think that was an amazing statement to wrap up the episode. And thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you for inviting me, Carl. It's been a pleasure.
Everybody listening, we'll be back next week and we'll talk to you then.